Hello and welcome to All About Brahmakumaris. My name is Meghla Pillay. I'm a judicial officer from South Africa, and we have here in the studio with us today B.K. Denise, who's been practicing Raja Yoga meditation with the Brahmakumaris for over 40 years. The topic for today's discussion is what the real purpose of the Brahmakumaris is. For those of you who are not familiar with the organization, the Brahmakumaris has been in existence in India for over 77 years, and they are currently in over 120 countries across the world. There are people practicing Raja Yoga meditation as taught by Brahmakumaris. Thank you, Sister Denise, and a very warm welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
Whilst the Brahmakumaris is fairly well known globally, there are obviously a number of people who do not know anything about the Brahmakumaris. Could you please tell us who and what the Brahmakumaris is?
I don't think we're well known globally at all.
You don't? Okay.
No. I think we're quite well known in India.
Mm-hmm.
But globally, not so. It's a very small number of people outside India who are studying and practicing the knowledge of Raja Yoga, and they belong to all kinds of different religious and cultural backgrounds. And as you said, there's activities in about 120 countries globally. So what Brahmakumaris is, many people ask this question, what are you? And my answer is, it is a yagya. So yagya is an Indian word, a Sanskrit word. A yagya is a sacrificial fire. A sacrificial fire is a process where you surrender all the things that are negative in your life. Because if, or to the extent that there is negativity in your life, to that extent, you experience suffering. So the idea behind it is to stop doing those karmas which cause you to suffer, which drain you of your spiritual energy. And so most people in the world, they do things thinking that they're good for them, but then they suffer from them. And they don't put two and two together and see that, well, you have this problem because of this karma. And so it's really to teach anyone who wants to know how to do such karma so that your present and your future existence is the very best possible. So that's a very important purpose. The organization of Brahmakumaris is really an interface or a legal instrument that allows the Brahmakumaris and the practice to occur in some place or another, in some country. And so you need, in order to do this, you need a place, you need to be able to create and distribute literature, you need to be able to hold public events if you wish, you need to be able to receive contributions to make all this happen. So the organization is really that level, but the actual what Brahmakumaris is very, very subtle. It's a teaching, it's a lifestyle, it's a form of consciousness, it's a way of being, and its aim is nothing less than the transformation of the world, the human world, the natural world, through transforming an individual, oneself.
When the Brahmakumaris was established way back in 1936 or 1937, there was already at the time an abundance of religions across the globe, was there not? Yes, and still are. Why is it that this simply didn't become absorbed in Hinduism, for example? Because if somebody looks at the Brahmakumaris from outside, and especially somebody dressed like that, you'll think, yet another Hindu organization. Let me go check it out and let's go learn to meditate. I want some peace. Why establish something new? What was the reason for that?
Well, you see...
My second question leading from that is, what does the Brahma Kumaris offer that no other religion or nothing else on earth does?
How did this happen is really an interesting thing to look at. The founder of Brahma Kumaris, Brahma Baba, was, up until the time of Brahma Kumaris, a quite devout Hindu of the Valbachari section of Hinduism. He was a believer in Vishnu, in Narayan, and he used to regularly study the Gita. So that was his background. He was a jeweler from Sindh, a self-made businessman, and he lived in Hyderabad. And then he experienced visions, he experienced many deep changes in his life. And if you look at his diaries, even right from 1932, there are some entries where he's really anticipating and really trying to think deeply about his mind. And he wants to have a pure mind. He's contemporary with Gandhi, contemporary with Rabindranath Tagore, and people at that time in India were trying to create a new kind of India. This is the time when India was coming out of being a colony of England, and there was a lot of, you can say, revolutionary activity going on in India, and especially Gandhi's aim was to achieve these political ends through non-violence. And he was also a studier of the Gita. Tagore was also studying the Gita. So very much there was importance given to the Gita. And in Brahma Kumaris also, there are many, many references made to what it says in the Gita. Now, our information that we work with is understood to come from the Supreme Soul. So this is really what is new and different, is that the Supreme Soul, the Supreme Father of all souls, comes on this earth and begins to say, you know, I'm here, and now I'm here to give you the fruit of your devotion. Now, in the Gita, there are some interesting phrases. One in particular that's often mentioned is that it's like God's promise that whenever there is the extreme of irreligion and unrighteousness in Bharat, Bharat is another word for India, then I come and I destroy the irreligiousness that is so widespread, and I establish true dharma. And so everybody wants to have true dharma. It's a very important concept. So in Brahma Kumaris also, the idea that God establishes true dharma, God presents himself as your father, your mother, your teacher, your satguru, your friend, and teaches you, leads you to the path of purity, the path of righteousness. And so what's very new at that time, people used to have very powerful spiritual experiences spontaneously, and no one knew where it came from. Brahma Baba experienced that too, and many of the people in his immediate community experienced that, and nobody really knew what was going on. So Brahma Baba used to have a satsang where he would read from the Gita, and he would chant the Om, which is a very common thing to do in India, chant the Om. And this was really with his immediate family. And he would chant the Om, and then people would experience visions. They would experience visions of Krishna, visions that corresponded to their religious beliefs. And it became famous. You know, if you go to Dada Lake Raj, that was his name at that time, you can have visions. And so people flocked. because they all enjoyed so much, you know, this experience. And then the society said, oh, this looks funny to us. This is not normal. People don't have visions like that. In India, it's considered a very, very high achievement of devotion over a long period of time to see these visions. Dada Lekaraj was very spiritually inclined and had a total of 12 gurus, but he was somehow never satisfied with them. And when this started happening, his gurus said to him, you know, this is out of our range. You're on your own here. We don't know what's going on. So he really was on his own. And he traveled to Benares, he traveled to Kashmir to try and figure it out, because he really was on his own. And then gradually, over time, he became aware that there was a power working through him. And after more efforts to try and figure this out, it became clear that this was the one who calls himself Shiva, the Supreme Being, the Supreme Soul, who has come from the world of Nirvana, who is not a human soul, who is the father of the souls, and he is here because the world cycle is changing and he has to renew the world socially, spiritually, energetically, geographically. And he would make mention to some of the scriptures which did say that a time will come when this happens. And so he's saying, I'm here, it's happening, and you, he said to Dada Lekaraj, you are my instrument, and I'm going to call you Brahma, because it is through Brahma that I create the new world. And so there is this idea of the other Brahma Kumars and Kumaris, that means daughters and sons of Brahma. So the relationship is that Shiva, through Brahma, says to you, you are my child, you're a soul. And if it clicks for you, if you recognize it and you say, yeah, I am a soul, I am your child, the relationship is sealed. And then, okay, he says, well, you know, I have to teach you. So we have to have an educational environment, we have to have a school. And so many things started to happen, which only now, 77 years later, 78 years later, are more formalized. But there was a lot of history that happened up until now. Brahma Baba left his body in 1969, and at that time it was still a very small group. They passed through Indian independence, partition. It became a solid group of about 300 who decided, yes, this is real for us. And then it was decided they would move to India after partition, 1951. They came to Mount Abu. Then what? Refugees. Around the time of partition, there was a great deal of civil disturbance, a lot of conflict between Hindus and Muslims, a huge bloodbath occurred. And he was told by one of the well-known gurus of his community that, okay, all of you, you want to do tapasya, you want to do meditation, so we would suggest you go to Mount Abu, because that's the best place for doing that. And this is why we came to Mount Abu. And there was a very great difficulty to set up. And so Brahma Baba sent all the brothers and sisters to the different cities where their family members also were, and said, okay, you serve your families spiritually. They had had 14 years by that time, 14 years of intense meditation. So they were very powerful yogis. And they just went out on a wing and a prayer, you know. And out of that came the beginnings of centers. And they would come backwards and forwards between Mount Abu and wherever. And Brahma Baba, as he became known, would go to Mumbai very often for the winter. The winter was very harsh in Mount Abu, and slowly it became formalized as a place of teaching, and this is where the word Ishwariya Vishwavidyalaya emerged, and that means, you know, our full name, Prajapita Brahma Kumar Kumari Ishwariya Vishwavidyalaya. Very few people can even say that, you know.
I certainly can't.
And it means the God's place of study for those who are the sons and daughters of Brahma, in which you learn education, you learn study, which covers matters of the whole world.
Mm.
And so this word Vishwavidyalaya. Now, if you translate that into English, it becomes university. And the authorities in India said, well, you can't use that word university because you have to be accredited and so on and so forth. And so they kept the Sanskrit word, Ishwariya Vishwavidyalaya. So, okay, that's what the name is, but it's very long. And then in the 60s, in the 70s, a few Brahma Kumaris Kumaris were invited outside India to participate in different conferences and so on. In 1971, very small centers were established in Hong Kong and in London. Then in 1974, Daddy Jenkey was sent to London, and it was then that Western people discovered it, and I was actually the first one in London to discover it. And after me, one or two others also started to come in. And there's a lot of people from all over the world, but slowly, slowly, it spread out with different people, taking the message of Brahma Kumaris to other places and meditating there and teaching, and then people started to say, yes, we want to be part of this too. But it's still a very, very small community of people in comparison with the rest of the world.
Mm.
But it is impressive to people who kind of follow the development of organizations, that even though Brahma Baba, the founder, and Mama Jagadamba Saraswati left their bodies, it increased even more after that happened in the 60s. And so Dadi Prakash Mani took over the responsibility after Brahma Baba left the body in 1969, and under her it really spread very far and wide, and she left the body 2007. And now I think that it's very widespread, and now the thought that's going on is now we have to deepen. The spiritual energy is what people really resonate with.
Very interesting. Why is it called Brahma Kumaris? Are Kumars or men welcome within this organization?
The full name is Prajapita Brahma Kumar Kumari Ishwariya Vishwavidyalaya, but there's a big thing to swallow. But Brahma Baba also said the women must be in front.
Why?
Because he saw a tremendous disequilibrium and a very male-dominated society. And in order to establish a society which is in equilibrium, women really needed to come up, and they needed to come into their own. So he gave a lot of leadership roles to the women, and he asked the brothers to be behind in a more of a supporting role, which was totally revolutionary at that time. Even now it is.
So what is the female-male population like in terms of numbers?
Well, it's pretty much 50-50.
Is it?
Yes. But what you always see is you always see far more women than men. So I'm not quite sure how that works. Maybe there are many men who are less visible, but in terms of the statistics that I saw. But at the same time, you know, spirituality, anywhere in the world that you go, you have lectures or whatever, you will find lots and lots of women taking it up, far more than men.
Why is spirituality more attractive to women than men?
I think one of the reasons is because it's all about the inside, the internal, the inner dimension, and men are biologically and socially oriented towards the outside world. In traditional societies, women look after the hearth, they look after the home, they take care of the atmosphere and the feeling, and the men go out there and create the money and get the food, and so that's just the traditional way of men and women. Religions tend to be very patriarchal, but spirituality tends to be more matriarchal.
What is the purpose of the Brahma Kumaris now? What are you actually doing now?
I think what we're doing now is consolidating this feeling of community and deepening the spiritual energy. The instruction that we're getting at the moment is really make your mind totally pure.
What is a typical day in the life of an employed Brahma Kumar and Kumari?
Well, I suppose everybody's different, but in general, you know, you will wake up early, you'll have your early morning meditation.
What is early?
Early means 3:30 in the morning.
See, okay.
You'll have your meditation from 4 to 4:45. Most of the morning classes in the centers are held from 6:30 to 8, and then you go to work. In a small center, the person who is looking after the center is also usually doing a job, so they will also make their food for the day before the morning class. Very often it's done like that. And then they will go out and do their day's work. They'll come back in the evening. They'll probably shower and change. And they'll have some meditation, and then they will have some the evening classes. So very often when people are learning about Brahma Kumaris, they'll come for a course, and that's usually held in the evening. And then they will go to sleep by 9:30, 10 o'clock. This is a typical day.
That's across the globe.
Más o menos, you know.
I see.
There are, for example, if you will ask me about my day, which it would be different, you see, because I will not go to work as such. But, you know, and I move around a great deal. I travel a lot, visiting the different centers. But most of my time when I'm not traveling will be in Mount Abu, which is here, or Shantivan, or London. And so there, the time period when an employed person will go to work, I will do my spiritual service in the center, so whatever projects I have. So all of us do some or another activity which is helpful for the center, or prepare the food for large numbers of people, or meet people, do classes, a variety of things.
Interesting. So there are Brahma Kumaris and Kumaris who have full-time jobs.
Yes, and there are some who have part-time jobs.
Yeah, those are part-time jobs. There are those who live at meditation center and those who do not live at the meditation center.
There are also a lot of people who are retired, or for one reason or another, they're not living in the center, they're also not working. So they will also spend time at the center during the day, helping with different things that are needed.
Yeah. What tools does the Brahma Kumaris give to individuals to help them live life differently from somebody who's not leading the life that you are? In other words, how is a Brahma Kumari different? Are they externally, they may look the same as anyone else they pass in the street, but how is a BK different?
I think mostly the consciousness, you know, and the consciousness is shown through your eyes. And how you handle the different challenges of the day. You asked about tools. We call them weapons. And in India, the same word for weapons and tools.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah.
The powers of yoga, the power to tolerate, the power to accommodate, the power to judge, the power to discern, the power to face, the power to withdraw, the power to pack up, the power cooperate. All of these powers, power of silence, the ability to love, the practice of non-attachment, you gradually become more and more supported directly by God. So you do not need to rely on some physical supports or depend on physical people emotionally or whatever. Also, Michael Murray's lead a simple life, so it's less expensive. And so that's also good. So then we are free to use our financial resources for more philanthropic activities, and in that way we are creating pure karma. So all the time generating pure karma, finishing off negative karma, and gradually transforming ourselves. So you become more and more empowered. Yes. And you see other people knowing how to do these things, not really clear about what's good karma, what's not so good karma, much more random, more into body consciousness, very much affected by health issues, financial issues, relationship issues. So I think Brahma Kumaris, Kumaris, they're very free. You really live a life of freedom.
You said earlier that there is a measure of resistance that every person who embarks on a spiritual journey experiences.
Definitely.
It can't possibly be easy to be a Brahma Kumari. It sounds as if you're describing somebody who's exceptional.
We have access to God. We have access to God's mind. We have access to teachings. We have access to each other. All of these things changes the situation. So that something which for someone may be very difficult, for us becomes very easy. Because you acquire skills, you acquire capacities, you increase your capacity as a person, as the days go by, and so you feel very, very competent, very capable, and so you become different, you know.
And I assume it's a lifelong work in progress, is it not?
Oh, it is, yes.
So it's not something, there's no question of by this time you're supposed to achieve this.
You can't say that, because everybody has their own pace, everybody has their own karmic accounts, everybody interprets it their own way. You know, I think probably it'd be safe to say that all the Brahma Kumaris and Kumaris meditate differently.
Okay.
But at the same time, when you're all meditating in the same room, there is an alignment of the minds that takes place, and eventually it becomes a massive alignment of the mind that creates a wave of pure thought that goes around the world, and that is going on a daily basis, subtly.
Oh, thank you. That was quite a packed session. I found that very informative, and I hope all of you at home did so as well. We thank Sister Denise for joining us today, and there you have it. The real purpose of the Brahma Kumaris: is there such a thing as a Brahma Kumar? How many there are across the globe? How many types there are? What the lifestyle involves, and what the aim of is of being a fully fledged member of the Brahma Kumaris. Brahma Kumaris community. We thank you for joining us this afternoon, and we hope to see you soon. Thank you and goodbye.